For the last week, and actually I should say since the beginning of June, the summer has been characterized by the fact that Swami Kriyananda, the founder of Ananda, direct disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda, has been in America. He lives essentially on three continents now. He has a home in Italy, in our community in Assisi, and one in Gurgaon, India, outside of New Delhi. And I was very pleased to hear him say he has a home in Palo Alto, referring to the house where David and I live, where he stays when he comes. I was very gratified that he included us in his list. And then he has a home in Ananda Village. And he's been in America since the beginning of June, and he will be till the end of September. And we're celebrating 40 years since Ananda Village, the first Ananda community, was founded, and 60 years, as of September 12th, since Swami Kriyananda met his guru, and on the same day that he met him, became a disciple, and in these 60 years since, has devoted his life to serving God. It has created a certain, a lot of really, really, really busy people this summer, just putting on all these events, which have been huge. This week has been Spiritual Renewal Week at Ananda Village, which is about 4 hours from here north and east. And there's been 500 people there all week. We came back today to share all with all of you. And it's caused me and all of us, I met Swami Kriyananda in 1969. So 40 years of Ananda is just slightly more than 40 years of my involvement in this spiritual path. And without meaning to belabor a point that is so obvious, but is not obvious until you're standing in this position, life goes by like that. And I was taking something, this is so trivial, but a year ago, more than a year ago, this lovely woman devotee named Vanamali Devi came through here in 2007 in May. She stayed in our house, she did some Indian cooking, and I put some of it in the freezer. This June, I was taking some of that out, and I was sure that it had just been cooked a month before, but I had to actually figure out that it had actually been a year and a month prior to that. And you just sort of turn around, and you just don't know where your life has gone. It's like picking up a handful of water. And so when you're celebrating 40 years, 60 years, I have very vivid memories of being 17, 18, 19, 20, and just the mere thought of having to do something for 6 months. You know, my parents would say something like, well, you could do it for a year. Heavens, if I wasn't enjoying it, I couldn't do it for a minute. What to speak of a year? And now I think, oh, well, we'll just do it for a couple of years and then we'll just go on to something else. There's this extremely elastic quality to time. And that's one of the clues that the masters have planted in this world to help us understand that things are not as they seem. You would think that time would be a fixed reality, but for little children, a day is just the longest period of time. It's such a joke, and I vividly remember, too, being in the back seat of the car with my brother and sister, and that incredible question you ask your daddy, are we there yet? How much longer? And it would just seem so long. I remember a lovely little child who had her dear father wrapped around her little finger. She was about 7, and we were going on a long car trip, and several of us were in the car, a few hours. And the father turned to the little girl at one point. She was, you know, now people have to ride in car seats in the back. And she was there, and he said, honey, how are you doing? You know, are you all right? How much longer, Daddy? Oh, it'll be about an hour. Angel, can you make it? She said, candy would help. That's sort of how we feel, isn't it? Candy would help. There's something to sort of sweeten the cycle. But what is most amazing to me, standing looking back at what, you know, one sees oneself through the eyes of others. There is this strange illusion. They say in the astral world, this is actually what I read somewhere, it might even have been Master, you have the body that you have when you're about 28. Seems like an odd number, 28. But that's sort of about when, you know, you're fully grown, but you haven't yet sort of crested and aren't really running down the other side of the hill yet. Maybe technically the chiropractors tell you your spine is already degenerating, but there's a certain beauty. But it's interesting that in the astral world, almost everyone has that fresh, young look. So there's something inherent about it. when Sri Yukteswar, the guru of Paramhansa Yogananda, returned to Master after he died, the resurrection of Sri Yukteswar, it's called in the autobiography of a yogi. And he had physically died, but because his consciousness completely transcended time, space, and matter, he reappeared in his physical body to reassure his disciple, and of course to make this incredible chapter in autobiography of a yogi. And Sri Yukteswar said, unlike most people, I've chosen in the astral world to have an older body. You know, his whole whatever demeanor, whatever you would call it, was more aged, so he looked just like he looks on the altar here on your right as you're facing it on the cross, white-haired. And but he said everyone else is young. And in fact, Rajasi Janakananda, the most advanced male disciple of Paramhansa Yogananda, after Yogananda passed away in 1952, Rajasi went into many ecstatic states and went into the astral world. And on Yogananda's birthday, when he was in the astral world, they had a party for him. This Rajasi just goes into an ecstatic state and tells everyone this. And he said, and Master appeared, about 28. You know, young, vibrant, like he was when he first came to America. So there's this sort of inner quality of vibrancy which manifests in a youthful body. But what we all know, if you are more than 28, is that your body just keeps going. My dear friend, who was very traumatized by reaching the age of 50, was even more traumatized when she reached the age of 51, because she said to me, I don't know, I just thought it would stop once I crossed that. But what really happens the older you get is you become more and more conscious of the discrepancy in reality between what your physical body is doing and what your consciousness is doing. You know, I remember realizing when I was an adult, well, my friend's mother, she was on her deathbed, she was in her 80s, and she said, she was a very sweet woman, and she said to her daughter, I always thought, she wasn't on this path, she was just an ordinary nice woman. She said, I always thought when I got older, I would get wiser, but I didn't. In a sense, that was a certain kind of wisdom, wasn't it? Just the sweet acceptance of what happens. Now, I would venture to say on the spiritual path, we do get wiser. We get much wiser as life goes by. Even a little practice of this inward religion saves us from dire fears and colossal sufferings. But one also realizes that the more time passes, the less anything actually happens. The more we understand, if we have lived consciously, that we're just a stream of energy. And when young people call you madam or miss or missus or sir or whatever it is they call you, and you sort of wonder why they're treating you with this unwarranted respect, and then you realize you're old enough to be their grandmother and maybe it's an appropriate response, but inside there's just this sense of flow of energy. Now this is what happens if we're devotees. I remember even, this was 20 years ago, I had to do some, it was political meetings. We were trying to make something happen when I still lived at Ananda Village. We're trying to incorporate Ananda as a California city, which is a very charming tale in itself, but I've written it in my book, so I can't give a sermon on it. We had this little farm of about 500 acres, and we wanted to have freedom of land use, and the only thing in California that would give that to us is a municipality. So we started playing the legal system against itself, because even though no normal person would think of us as a city, we actually met the qualifications, and we had to go through this whole process. We failed miserably, but it was a great adventure, and I was trying to get support from our neighbors. Many of our neighbors were very of-the-earth kind of people. They had gone into that rural area, our neighbors meaning Nevada County, in the mountains. They lived in a rural way. They sort of prided themselves in being part of this material plane. They built houses that kind of blended into the forest. They lived really natural in all these different ways. But all of it created in them a very strong sense of matter being the primary force. That they were much more concerned with the physical demonstration of the way they lived. I don't mean that they were unkind people, but that was just their orientation. They looked and seemed so much older than me, even though we were of the same age. And what I realized, because I was just so puzzled being in their company, I mean, I could write it up to things like I had a more healthy lifestyle and I meditate and things like that, but it was much more subtle than that. It was simply that they were defined by the physical world, and therefore as their bodies aged, they aged with it. Because so much of their life was through their bodies that whatever their body could and couldn't do became who they were. And I realized to what a tremendous extent on the spiritual path, we just define ourselves by the consciousness. Consciousness is ageless. It's the most peculiar thing when you see a very large choir of Ananda people, because before they sing, it's self-evident. You know, there's people with white hair, and there are people who are moving a little stiffly, and people with wrinkles of experience, and then some people who are quite young and vibrant and light, like young people can be. But when they start to sing, and they're singing together, you can't tell how old anyone is. It's just like this consciousness that is the unified vibration of that music just comes through them, and it's almost like all their faces become that ageless reality of that music. It's a very, very interesting thing, and I know the people, and I'm looking right at a face that I know for a fact is 75 years old, and I can't really tell how much older it is than the 20-year-old girl who's standing next to it. Now, think about what that means internally, and where I was beginning with all of this is having spent all these years on the spiritual path, there's a beautiful story, and I'm not going to claim this as my consciousness by any means, but I've heard it said so many times, and one finally begins to understand. There was a young man who wanted to be a devotee of God, and there was a great guru. And this young man, this I don't know if this is a true story or apocryphal, but it's beautiful. He goes to the guru and he says to the guru, I want to learn to know God. And he says, very, very good, my son. He said, but for now, would you please, you know, we need to keep the stove burning in the house here, and we need to keep the water tanks filled. So if you could please take this bucket and, you know, fill the water tanks from the river, if you could please take this axe and this saw and keep the wood box filled, we would be very grateful. So the young man is, certainly, master, whatever you want. So he begins to chop and saw the wood, and he carries the water. And disciples come and go. People have initiations. They have satsangs all this time. But his guru never gives him another instruction. The only instruction he was ever given was to keep the water tanks full, keep the wood box. And so just day after day, he gets up every day, and that's what he does. And then one day he's carrying the wood, and a little bit of his beard catches in the wood, and he sees as the hair is pulled out that his hair has turned white. And he remembers being a young man, and how did he get a white beard? And he goes over to a place where there's the water is clear, and he looks in and he sees the reflection, and he sees that his hair is white, his beard is white. He's become an old man, and all this time, all he's ever done put water in the tank and wood in the firebox. And all of a sudden, his whole life has passed, he feels, and he begins to weep. And just as the tears begin to fall, his guru rushes out of the house and with his own hands catches the tears in his cupped palms like this. And he says, oh, my child, he said, don't you understand that if the tears of a great soul like you touch the earth, there will be 7 years of famine here? And because of the curse, you know, that would be caused by such a great soul being made sad in that place. This is an apocryphal story. And then the guru touches the disciple on the chest and he immediately goes into cosmic consciousness. Now, this story has many levels. It has the story of attunement. It has the story of cooperation with those whom we respect. It has the lesson of perseverance. It has the lesson of self-forgetfulness, but also has the lesson, the interesting lesson of the illusion of time, doesn't it? Now, on the spiritual path, the confusion that we have sometimes is that we feel we have so many choices, and we have so many ideas, especially nowadays in our society, of how we're so concerned about fulfilling ourselves and doing this and doing that, and there's not wrongly, but there's so much emphasis on the individual. I love the emphasis on the individual. Even as a child, when I would read books in cultures where the individual was subservient to the family, to society, and so on. It used to make me so mad. I just get furious. You know, a 10-year-old, 12-year-old child. I don't know how many of you know the book Anna Karenina by Tolstoy. Right, that book still infuriates me. This woman has a very unhappy marriage, and she falls in love with a dashing soldier, and so she repudiates her husband. This is all in Russia, and maybe, what, the 1800s? I don't know where it's set. She repudiates her husband. She goes off with her dashing soldier. But she then is scorned by society as a fallen woman. Now he, I mean, they talk about double standards. He's fine. He can just keep going along, but she's now become a pariah, and she eventually throws herself under a train. You know, I mean, it, of course, all this takes, what, 1,000 pages to happen, but but I can just remember reading that book, and I was just getting so mad about every part of it because of the oppression of the individual and being held in society's rules, and just infuriates me. So I like America. I like the individual freedom. And in fact, one of the reasons that Master's movement of self-realization started here in this country is because of that. Because self-realization requires the courage to really stand by your own truth. In Europe and also in India, I mean, we've been established, Ananda has been established now in Europe for more than 20 years. But at the beginning there, we met the same family issue. We'd say, well, why don't you come and live in our community in Assisi? And they would say, but my family lives in Rome. And the Americans would say, and? I mean, like, so? I mean, Americans leave home at 18 and just go anywhere in the world, but, you know, in Italy and Europe and many of those countries, it's where your family is, that's what you do. In India, we encourage people to take discipleship, but they may not because their parents haven't given them permission, or the father won't take it until the son is ready. I mean, there's just all this, and it has a certain nobility to it, and it also has an unbearable oppression to it, because then everybody's karma is all bound up. And the kind of freedom that we need in order to realize God, it's automatic to the American consciousness. And yes, I've had lots of discussions with both my European and my Indian friends, to use those two examples, about the pros and cons of this. I'm not blind to it, so I don't want to receive a lot of emails after this. I really do understand both sides of it. But what I'm talking about is the fact that there comes a certain point on the spiritual path where it's really just between you and God. When Master was a disciple of Sri Yukteswar in India, and his father at one point started to repeat to Master some slight criticism of Sri Yukteswar, and Master drew himself up and looked at his father. He said, human birth is something, but divine birth is everything. If you say one more word against my guru, I renounce you as my father forever. And his father didn't. You know? But that is sometimes what happens. Human birth is something, but how long does this body last compared to the consciousness that's within it? You know, how many millions of fathers and mothers have we had? And it's the same soul just going on and on and on. You know, sometimes I know that this lifetime and the influence of the parents means something, but let's not flatter ourselves, really. The trajectory of the soul's destiny is begun long before that child enters the womb of the mother and will go on long after the mother has passed away and the father has passed away. We're just on this long journey together. But you see, the most important element of this, and I often quote this from Yogananda because it's so powerful, he says, take care of the minutes and incarnations will take care of themselves. That's so hard to understand, isn't it? And it seems somehow counterintuitive. Isn't that phrase they use, counterintuitive? That you just think, well, if this is the big picture, I have to have the big picture. But all we ever are, at any moment in time, first of all, we're always standing in the now. I know this is a wonderfully popular thought now, and it's a very good thought. It's always now. We, of course, scatter our attention between the past and the future constantly, and often we miss what's actually happening. But the fact of the matter is, no matter how far it is in the future, when it happens, it's just going to be in the exact moment, right now. And the consciousness that you have, that we have, right in this moment, it's not a fixed thing. It's not a material object. It's not an elephant carved in stone. I mean, just feel your own consciousness. It's a total collection, isn't it, of everything that's happened right up until this moment. How much you slept, what you ate, whether you had an argument with someone. And an hour from now, there's going to be an entirely other collection of influences on us, isn't there? And we'll just be thinking, I mean, it's now 8 minutes to 11, at 8 minutes to 12. Look at your consciousness. It'll be completely different, and you won't be able to resurrect exactly what you are now. You may be able to remember that you were sitting here. I hope you remember that you were sitting here. But still, we won't be able to capture the essence of what our consciousness was right then, because it's just gone. All we ever are is the sum total of everything we've been doing right up to that moment. And how do you think we got into the present mess, or the present whatever, if you like, where you are? It's just by all that accumulation of thought, action, desire, dedication, devotion. That's very good news in another sense. I remember once in my life, not just once, but I remember one time in my life, I'd gotten myself mentally into quite a state. I had just been making a whole series of wrong choices, and the cumulative effect of those wrong choices was causing me quite a bit of misery. And you know how it is, it seemed like a good idea at the time, and you make a lot of mistakes, and then all of a sudden you find yourself someplace where you really don't want to be. And my nature, as Swamiji said, guilt is a wonderful excuse for not actually changing, because you just feel so guilty, then there you sort of have this sense that you're accomplishing something, because after all, you feel so bad, don't you? But often it's a way of just sort of draining the energy out and not actually having to put out the energy to discipline yourself in a new direction. So I was running one of those scripts that I don't run those scripts very much anymore, thank you, Lord, but I ran them really, really well for a really long time. It's a story I knew extremely well. And I was sort of falling into the usual cycle of sadness and all those other things. And then just this thought occurred to me. It was such a powerful thought. Honey, you just walked yourself into this mess. Just reverse your steps and walk out. It was just so clear to me. I had just, a collection of wrong attitudes and wrong actions had led me into this cul-de-sac, and it was a really lousy place to be. So all I had to do was turn around and do exactly the opposite. You know, because we tend to feel like, oh, it's my karma, it's my astrology, it's what the psychic said was going to happen, it's my DNA, it's my genetics, it's, you know, whatever it is. But, you know, all those are just words for the accumulation of our own thoughts, desires, actions, and responses to life. It's not mysterious. It feels mysterious, but it's not at all mysterious. It's just a minute-by-minute decision about what we're going to do. And this was a very interesting one. I've shared this with you before, but let me tell some of you have not always been here. And some of you may not actually remember everything I've ever said. Oh, what a shock. Okay. But that in that little cycle, I lived in Ananda Village then, and I had to go into town to the supermarket. And of course, you know how it is with the aisles in the supermarket. You go by and you get a little glimpse of reality. And there was this family, this couple actually, at the community, and I didn't like them very much. They just had their whole way of living and their attitude toward life just wasn't compatible with mine. They were not people I would ever choose to be with. So I'm in this, you know, sort of cloud of crumminess. And I go down the aisle and I catch a glimpse of them. And so my first impulse is to pretend I haven't seen them and just go on, right, like that. But just as I was about to make that movement, it occurred to me that the definition of the cul-de-sac that I'd gotten myself into was so much concern about myself and my own likes and dislikes and just always hoarding my energy and never thinking about other people and just what about me and nobody's taking care of me and why don't they think about me more, you know, just all that. It's always ego. And so I said, well, maybe I should just maybe give some good energy to someone else. Golly, what a revolutionary concept. So I just turned back and I just marched down that aisle to these people I didn't particularly like and just decided to see them as children of God and just be in joy. Why not? And we just talked, and it was very odd. We made a bond at that point that has endured to the present. It's not like we really have anything more in common than we did, but I think Divine Mother just wanted me to really understand. I totally enjoyed my connection with them and have enjoyed it ever since. And it was like, this is in our own hands. We don't for one minute ever have to think. Now I know people sometimes get kind of mad at the spiritual path because how can it all be my fault? There was this wonderful, not wonderful, wonderful because it was so awful, little vignette I saw once on television, and it was somebody had decided that they were going to make a definitive decision about whether there was a mind-body connection in terms of health, and they were going to do it by taking a survey of cancer patients. Now that's really good, isn't it? It'll talk about really sound philosophy and science. So they surveyed this, I'm being sarcastic, so they surveyed this, I recall this cancer, this woman who had cancer, and they interviewed her and they asked her, do you think there's a connection between your own mental processes and this disease that you have now? She said, hell no, it's bad enough having cancer. I certainly don't want it to be my fault. I mean, that's basically how we feel, isn't it? It's bad enough that a bad thing has happened to me. I don't want to take responsibility for it too. But if we don't take responsibility for our consciousness, every day is, well, it's a living terror, isn't it? Because we don't know how we got here and we don't know how to get out of it. But just that very simple thought, my consciousness is the accumulation of every single thought, action, and feeling I've had until this moment, and I walked myself into wherever I am, and I can walk myself out of it by taking care of the minutes. Now, we have a whole Sangha and Teaching Center here to tell you how to do that. Sermons are only designed to inspire you to do something about it. Google changing consciousness and see what you find. You know, meditation, devotion. But the most important thing is just to realize that you can. That no matter how strong the force that seems to be preventing you, it's absolutely nothing but the accumulation of your own habit. And yes, you're going to have to put out as much energy undoing it as you did doing it. But what happens is you start flowing with the river of grace. It's the divine matching fund, I call it. You put out one erg of energy and God puts 25 out for you. It's like a big savings jar. You put in a penny, he puts in a dime. Once you start working to be an instrument of God instead of just an indulgence of your own self-concern, then all of a sudden there's this beautiful light force pushing behind you. And what happens to you? I'm by no means old, but you get as old as I am, or you get into your 10th or 20th or first anniversary on the spiritual path, and you look back and you think, wow, what a glorious journey. And look who I used to be, and look who I am now. What joy, what joy, what joy. That's what Swamiji always says about the spiritual path. It's not an all or nothing proposition. You start, and from the first moment you decide to live according to the divine law, everything gets better. Sri Yukteswar said it so simply, everything in future will improve if you make a spiritual effort now. God bless you.